From Australian Book Review, this is the ABR podcast, home to some of the magazine's finest reviews, interviews, poetry, fiction, and commentary. My name's Peter Rose, and I'm the editor of ABR. By now, many listeners will have read Theodore L.'s essay, Facades of Lebanon, winner of the 2021 Caliber Essay Prize. We published it in our July issue, and Theodore went on to read his essay on the ABR podcast, a powerful and coruscating reading. Listening to it in the car, I nearly had to pull over when Theodore described the Beirut explosion that nearly killed him and his wife in 2020. On this week's podcast, Theodore reflects on the gestation of Facades of Lebanon, the emotions of an essayist tackling such traumatic experience, his complex responses to Lebanon, and the plight of that beautiful, fraught country. Theodore is in conversation with his friend BJ Silcox, a regular on the ABR podcast and a senior contributor to the magazine. BJ was in the Middle East at much the same time, living in Cairo with her diplomat husband. BJ Silcox.
Greetings, ABR listeners and readers. This is BJ Silcox, and it is my pleasure today to speak to poet, translator, Caliber Prize winning essayist, dear friend and all-round magic gentleman, Theo L., Dr. Theodore L. Welcome, Theo.
Thank you, BJ. It's wonderful.
Theo and I met in 2017 when we were sat next to each other in an Arabic language night class at ANU. We were both there because of colliding love stories. Theo was Beirut bound, following his beautiful girlfriend, now wife, Katie, who was posted with DFAT to be deputy ambassador in Beirut. And I was following my husband to Cairo, where he was going to take up the same post. So we bonded as accompanying spouses, preparing for a new adventure and uprooting our lives. But then our friendship became deeper over the fact that we were both writers and readers. Two bookish wordsmiths setting off to watch and read and record our new Middle Eastern lives. I visited Theo in Beirut, Theo visited me in Cairo, but when COVID struck, our friendship became a quite necessary and dear support network, as I was separated by international borders from my husband, and Theo and Katie weathered the Beirut port explosion. Theo carried a notebook with him in Beirut, everywhere, carrying impressions of the place, and from that notebook, he pulled out Facades of Lebanon, this year's Caliber Prize winning essay, which is what we're going to talk about today. Not the harrowing experience behind it, but the literary achievement of it, because it is an extraordinary essay. So welcome, Theo.
Thank you, BJ. I've always wanted to call someone my opposite number in Cairo, little thinking that I actually would. I feel very lucky indeed that it was you. I should also just say that the notebook that I carried round, you and Sam gave to me, and it survived the explosion, I'm glad to say. It was blown about, including being blown out of a window into a window box, but it was obviously destined to survive and to come home to Australia as well.
How lovely. It was covered in scarabs.
It was covered in scarabs, and, well, sadly it was covered in powdered glass for a while, but got rid of that.
So, Theo, this is your first attempt at the Caliber Prize, your first attempt at a personal essay, and it has taken the top spot this year. Can you account for yourself, please, you talented bastard?
Good heavens, I wish I could explain it. I mean, I can tell you what happened, but I can't necessarily explain it.
So this was a quarantine writing project?
It was a quarantine writing project, yes. I had thought in the aftermath of the explosion, in the weeks that followed it, that I would have to write something about it eventually, and so I kept a diary of the aftermath, and I wrote down every memory, every impression, every thought that I could possibly capture. But I wasn't sure how or when I would come to write the piece. Then my wife and I agreed that she would end her posting early, and she very happily got a promotion to a different government department. So that was the catalyst for us coming home. And in finding ourselves in quarantine in January was very strange. We were in a hotel room with no balcony or openable windows overlooking Hyde Park in Sydney. And I had been to high school not far away. So there we were. It was like we were stuck in a glass box with who I had been and who we had become replaying constantly over and over outside the window and inside our minds. And so it was a bit like being in the waiting room to return to normal life.
And it felt like the right time to write it.
It did. Writing it was not easy, even though I had managed to get down a lot of the topic and some of my impressions over the preceding months. But in quarantine, with not much else to do, it was a unique opportunity just to focus and shape it into something I hoped would be readable and accessible, and that told a story, and it wasn't just a disconnected series of observations.
And can you confirm or deny that someone in this room gave you a big kick up the backside?
I can confirm that, and I will put it on record that it was you. you gave me two big kicks up the backside, in that you kicked me up the backside to get me writing the piece, and then you kicked me up the backside to enter it into the Calibre, which I had not even thought of doing when I started preparing to
This is
write.
The most glorious I told you so of my life.
Yeah.
Because it does in fact win the Calibre Prize, and how has it felt to win it?
It's been just astonishing, because I took the incentive to enter it for the prize as a spur to get the piece written and finished. I thought that, all right, I'll get it down on paper and I'll get it off and I'll submit it and that'll be it. And maybe I'll come back to the subject in a year or so when I'm ready and enough time has passed. Then actually to win it, my gosh, I mean, it's a bit more than a month ago now that I got the phone call from Peter Rose, the editor of the ABR and one of the prize judges. And I just absolutely melted. I could barely believe what had happened. It's very difficult to explain just how it felt, but it was a feeling of joy and elation and an absolute contrast to the feelings that my wife and I had during the explosion and afterwards. If you'd told me while we were picking our way through rubble and fallen masonry and with sharp glass shards everywhere, picking our way out of our building to get to safety, that in a year or so this will turn into a literary prize, I would have said, "You're joking. That's impossible." Neither of us knew we were even going to survive that night.
And it's so, been this incredible bookend.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I have one emotional question about that time, a fraught question, an urgent question, the question that's on everybody's lips. Where is Jazzy the Cat?
Jazzy the Cat. Well, Jazzy the Cat, I'm glad to say, is safe and well, as she was on the night of the explosion, luckily, as it turned out. Jazzy, which is short for Jasmine, is in Greece now, of all places. Because we're
in a
cat and dog boarding place, and she's there because we're in the process of bringing her to Australia, which of course requires strict quarantine and vaccinations and rabies checks and all kinds of things. And she's in Greece because you can't do this directly from Lebanon. We just don't have the agreements and the reciprocal recognition.
So can you tell me? Because it is a quite joyful story of your time in Beirut.
Yeah, well, it is.
Can you tell me the story of Jazzy the Cat?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's a long story. I'll try to pot it. But I do have to say that a lot of our experiences in Beirut, the vast majority, in fact, were very happy and joyful and interesting. It's just that the explosion, plus hard COVID lockdowns cast a bit of a black cloud over it all. But Jazzy was one of the most joyful elements of our lives. We were on a brief weekend, a little getaway in the southern part of the Bekaa Valley, which is the valley that separates Lebanon from Syria. And it's a mostly rural area with a few small towns in it. We were staying in one of those towns, and we'd been wandering about that part of the valley during the day. We went to the wetlands there, and it's a spectacular landscape. And there we were in this beautiful garden and orchard belonging to the B&B where we were staying. And there was this tiny little kitten who was dusty and dirty and a little bit thin, but obviously very happy and enjoying herself. And she quite obviously didn't belong to anyone. She wasn't being looked after. She didn't belong to the owners of the B&B. And she wormed her way directly into our hearts. She jumped into Katie's handbag. She curled up on our laps at breakfast. I think she knew exactly what she was doing.
She chose you.
She did choose us. And honestly, I think she became the luckiest little kitten in all of Lebanon, because we catnapped her. But she quite obviously didn't belong to anyone. The staff were just ignoring her, and you know, she had nowhere to go. There was no mother cat around, obviously. So we just picked her up, bundled her into Katie's straw hat, and drove her back over the mountains to Beirut.
So tell me about life in Beirut. Your essay starts in a very pointed moment of quiet in this city at the beginning of the COVID lockdowns. But what was your everyday life like? What was your neighbourhood like?
Well, yes, the essay does start in the eerie quiet of lockdown in the spring of 2020. And I do have to underline just how strange that period was, because Beirut is normally a very noisy city. The traffic is just deafening. It's and it's continuous day and night.
I'm very familiar with that particularly.
Yes, in Cairo, I can imagine. I've heard it. I think Cairo is the loudest city in the world.
Somebody's 85 decibels background noise, which is the same basically as a small rock concert.
Good heavens. So I mean, somebody's worked that out. I think Beirut can't be far behind. But the neighbourhood that we were living in is it's in the eastern half of Beirut. It's called Jemaizeh, and it's in the eastern half, and it's one of the old, very, very oldest suburbs of Beirut, which as a modern city is a relatively new arrival. I mean, it's been an ancient site for centuries, but it wasn't until really the 1920s that it started to grow very fast. And Beirut is very much, it was a Cold War city in the sense that it was split down the middle, not because it was split between, say, communism and democracy, but because during the 70s and the 80s and the Civil War, the Christian, mostly Christian groups held the eastern half of the city, and mostly Muslim groups held the west.
And now this is the infamous Green Line.
The Green Line, yes. It ran down the middle of the city, and it was called that because the main road that this line followed just overgrew with plants and trees growing through the tarmac, and so it was quite literally a green line.
A forest boundary.
Yes, indeed. And in this eastern half of the city where we ended up living, apart from Arabic, which is spoken everywhere, the major language was French. And so you would go out into the street and hear French spoken in the shops and and by people around you. It's also a city. It's also a part of the city where more of the old limestone buildings, which we would probably call villas today, survive. And they're up back alleys and round odd corners, and they have the most beautiful, elegant style with pointed arched windows and ornate trimmings in the window frames. and just beautifully proportioned, simple but beautifully proportioned stairways and doorways. A lot of them, sadly, are very run down and potholed and pitted and decaying, but there's a different atmosphere in eastern Beirut to the more concrete jungle parts of the rest of the city.
You paint a really evocative picture of this place, and one of the things I've been grappling with, you know, my time in Cairo was always going to be limited. Always going to be through the lens of being an expatriate in this place, in a very rarefied and strange atmosphere of being a diplomat's wife. And also as a writer, and one of the things I've struggled with since, because I have a complicated relationship with Cairo, it was a city that changed me in profound and difficult ways, was how do you write a place that doesn't belong to you and to which you will never belong, but that has had such an outsized impact on you? And it's something I've been struggling with on the page, and it's something that you've done quite extraordinarily here. But I'd really love to hear your thoughts on that. How do you tell the story of this place?
Oh, what a wonderful question. I identify absolutely with your description of negotiating life in Cairo in those terms. I have to say that Beirut, in the first 3 or 4 months, I liked a great deal about it, and I felt that eventually I would come to like it and be well adjusted to it. But it was very confronting in the first few months because of its violent history is still very, very evident. In you see bullet holes in walls everywhere. You can see buildings that haven't been rebuilt that were bombed or collapsed during the war. The traffic is hair-raisingly dangerous, it's just a very different place to any Australian city that we know, and the poverty and the quite evident desperation and animosity between different communities. Now that was quite shocking to see. Lebanon's a deeply divided country along lines of religion, but also class and money and opportunity. These things all very much align, and so the political slogans and the demonstrations you would sometimes see would be very fierce, and you would also see people with firearms in the streets, heavily armed soldiers with assault rifles, but also just dudes tinkering with scooters with handguns poking out the back of their trousers. And so all this was a lot to take in, but above all it was the people who made it comfortable and easy in the end to get to know, because everybody we met in everyday life from any community, wherever we happened to be in the city or in the country at the time, they were so warm and hospitable and curious and welcoming. As, oh, you're from Australia. Come in. What's Australia like? And have you met my cousin who's in Melbourne or Sydney? And so it was first and foremost the people who made it, who made that first opening. Because the people we met would, you know, be very warm and conversational.
Which takes us to the essay itself, which is an account or includes an account of the Beirut Port explosion, but it is not solely an account of surviving the Beirut Port explosion. In fact, it's the coda of an essay which is, in fact, a sort of love letter to Beirut and the politics of Beirut. Another author might have started us inside the chaos and the harrow, but you don't. You start us at the beginning of something else, at the beginning of the quiet. Why was it important to you to tell the lead-up story? Why was it important for you for this not to be just an essay of trauma?
Well, you're right. It was a very deliberate decision, and it was almost the only planning decision I made in writing the essay. I felt that the explosion could and probably would dominate everything else far too easily. And so I thought it had to be pushed to the back. It had to be pushed out of the spotlight. Because it was, to me, starting in the middle of the explosion in medias res and then working backwards and thinking, how did we get here? That would have been far too obvious. I felt that the real story was, in fact, Lebanon. The explosion was not the story. It was only part of the story. Because you're right. In a lot of ways, I suppose, the essay can be seen as a love letter to Lebanon and a lot of aspects of that country. But I felt that I wanted to reflect my experience of having lived there for 2 years. And I wanted to reflect that as it happened. I wanted to explain to people just how much suffering this country and its people have been through. I wanted to bring it to people's attention, and I felt that it would be much more effective to do that by revealing things to readers as they were revealed to me. To treat the essay as a shared exploration, if you like. I didn't necessarily know quite what insights I was going to draw from the events I was narrating until I'd narrated them. And I felt that if I had let the explosion dominate the story, then I'd always be struggling to keep up with it. So I just wound the story right back to where I felt the trajectory of the explosion really began in my mind.
I think what's extraordinary about reading your essay is that you very much do not place yourself at the centre of this story. This is a story about Lebanon, which you were a part of, as opposed to this was a trauma that happened to you, which also happened to Lebanon. And I think that change of focus, that you are looking at the whole in order to understand the part, as opposed to looking at the part in order to understand the whole, is a really important shift, and goes back to that question I had before about how do you write a place that doesn't belong to you. Well, you don't make yourself the star of the story.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It would have been totally wrong for me to do that. Because it would risk slipping into what a New Zealand writer and critic called Andrew Smith once wonderfully described as the inhumanity of the picturesque. I don't know if he's ever sort of written that phrase down in an article or an essay, but I think he should, because I think it's a wonderful conception. I know it because I've heard him speak about it. I wanted first and foremost to write about Lebanon as a place, and as a place with a history, and people and places and events as I saw them, but without standing between the reader and those places and events. It was a fine line to tread, but it was quite deliberate, and I solved it almost by just subtracting myself, subtracting the pronouns I or we from as many of the descriptions as I could possibly. I mean, for example, there's a passage about going up to the Qadisha Valley, a very beautiful, extraordinarily beautiful, actually.
Where the fruit is rotting because there are no pickers.
That's right. That's right. And in that that passage, instead of I felt I had to do two things. Firstly, well, I had to tell the facts about why we were there. So yes, the pronouns I and we appear insofar as we went there, we did this, I saw this. But apart from that, I just described the surface of objects and things and people, and let those factors stand on their own. At least that's what I attempted to do.
I think you did an extraordinary job.
Oh, that's very kind. The other thing is, that, I mean, for example, in describing the lockdown, as far as I can remember, I mean, I wrote the essay, but I haven't read it. But
have you not gone back to it?
No, I don't revisit it. The only time I did revisit it was to read it for the ABR podcast, and I did that without a rehearsal, because it's too hard. It's too hard to go back, especially over the passages about the explosion.
So I do have a question about that, and do tell me if you feel uncomfortable answering it, but you have written about a time in your life that is incredibly wrenching and incredibly traumatic, and I'm sure writing it itself was its own form of catharsis and difficulty, but now it's published and now it's out in the world and people are talking about it and asking you questions about it. How does that feel?
It's a strange feeling, but it's actually not as distressing and disturbing as you might think. I might not be able to go back and reread the essay itself and relive the events in my own mind, but having written it, it was a catharsis. Writing it was in a form of getting to grips with it. And to get the thing down in black and white on four square paper feels as if I've we can call it a draw, so to speak, the explosion and me. And so now that people are asking about it, well, there are just certain facts I find easy to explain and describe to people because it was so big and so many people realized that it happened. I was reciting it almost. So I can get the experience across in words without having to delve deep into my own memories and relive them. That said, my wife and I did have post-traumatic stress disorder. We probably still do. We have been seeing psychologists. We have all of these other techniques to deal with it. So, I'm on par with it, but also
you've pinned it to the page.
Pinned it to the page. That's a wonderful way to put it. Also, in the act of writing, I wrote about it last in the essay, precisely because I thought it would be more illuminating and more interesting for readers if I wrote about all the other stuff first, all of the other things about Lebanon. Because, as I keep saying, it was quite wonderful in all sorts of ways. And when you're in a strange place, it heightens your senses. You're alert to strange and unfamiliar sounds or patterns of speech or patterns of behavior or beautiful and interesting sights and scenes. And so Lebanon being the extraordinarily different place from Australia that it is, my impressions of Lebanon were so vivid that it wasn't hard to revisit other experiences than the explosion, and to explore them in my mind and get them down.
You are just such a poet, aren't you?
I don't know about that.
One of the things I did want to ask you about, in a sense, is that as Australians, as Australian readers, we're not particularly exposed to the wealth of the incredible literature of the Arab world and the incredible poetry of the Arab world, these grand ancient traditions of poetry writing, and then this vivid, incredible contemporary literature. What were you reading? Because it was wonderful, I think, for me to immerse myself in the writers of place, for the place that I was in, so that I could understand Cairo through the eyes of the people who had been writing it for generations. Who were you reading in Lebanon?
I was reading all kinds of authors. It was remarkable because I haven't had that degree of freedom to read and write anything I wanted since, my gosh, undergraduate uni, practically, which was about 15 years before going to Lebanon. And so I read almost anything I could get my hands on. I was deliberately exploring the literature of Lebanon in particular, but also the Arab world more broadly, with a view maybe to writing some sort of academic work on it eventually. And to start with the poetry, the poetic tradition of the Arab world is quite different to the poetic traditions, at least of the European poetic traditions that we've inherited in Australia. I would say that if readers now wanted to approach Arabic poets and poetry, the two figures they could start with that I encountered in my readings are a poet originally from Syria who takes the pen name Adonis and is translated into English by a Libyan American poet called Khaled Matawa, or the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who's been translated by various people. And they write about many things. I mean, Darwish was fated to have to write about the Nakba, as the Arabs describe the coming of the State of Israel and the displacement of the Palestinian people. I had already read some Adonis in a sort of selected poetry volume translated by Khaled Matawa, and I had that with me. But this was the ideal place and time to start exploring Darwish and the poetry of Palestinian people. And there were a couple of anthologies. There was one of writing on the Nakba, which begins with Darwish but includes many others. And then there was an anthology which was extremely powerful, including Darwish and Adonis and one or two other poets, called Victims of a Map.
Victims of a Map.
Victims of a Map. Beautiful. And I still have that. So that was where my reading began with the poetry. I read another Lebanese poet, a woman called Venus Khoury Gata, who has divided her time between Lebanon and France and writes in French. She's also written novels. And that was an extraordinary story because Venus Khoury Gata was born into, I suppose you could call it, an aristocratic Lebanese family. And in her early life, her childhood and teens, it was her brother who was really shaping up to become a poet. But then he tragically died at a very young age, and she took up the flame herself and decided she would become a poet in his place. Yes. And she writes in French, and the first poem in the first book of hers that I read, Les mots étaient des loups, words were wolves. It was this sort of, it opened with a kind of a paean to the act of writing poetry. She almost sort of staked her claim. And she said her ambition was d'être le seul maître du jeu, to be the sole master of the game. I thought that was really remarkable.
What a sentence.
Yes. Now, unfortunately, I don't think she's been translated very much, if at all. So perhaps the only way to come at her is if you read French.
So if you have one recommendation for ABR listeners and readers,
I have two.
Excellent.
I have two. Perhaps three. There are two great Lebanese novelists. I mean, there are many great novelists that I read, and I've got a whole list of them. But I think if people wanted to start, they could read the works of Amin Maalouf, who has spent many years living in France, but writes wonderful, tender and imaginative historical novels about Middle Eastern history, imagining himself back along the Silk Road, for example, in Samarkand, or into the gardens of ancient Persia, writing about the philosopher Mani. If they want to read one of his books about Lebanon, I recommend one called Ports of Call. That's the English title. The French title is Les Échelles du Levant, The Rungs of the Levant, which is about a love between two lovers. One of them is Jewish, one of them is an Arab, and it's a pained story of love between the two Levantine lands of Lebanon in the north and Israel-Palestine in the south.
It sounds like an extraordinary book.
It is a very remarkable book, yes. There's another novelist who lives in New York, Elias Khoury, who's a very distinguished journalist as well. His works are very dramatic and emotionally very raw. I think he's a very fine writer, but he's not an easy writer. I've read a book of his very early in our time there called The Journey of Little Gandhi, which is about a shoeshiner in the Civil War in Beirut. It's very well done, but it's harrowing. So the third novelist I would recommend is a writer called Sharif Majdalani, and of all of them, he's the one who made the deepest impression on me. I read a novel of his called, in French, Le Dernier Seigneur de Marsade, which means The Last Lord of Marsade. I don't think it's been translated, unfortunately, but other books by Majdalani have. Now, the reason this novel impressed me so much was, first of all, it was brilliantly written. I mean, it was the language was straightforward, crisp, clear, and curt. But the thing is that each chapter unfolds in a single paragraph. I mean, the sentences are all perfectly grammatical. You know, there's no stylistic experimentation except for the fact that the paragraphs do not break. And what you feel is this incredible building of tension.
Yes.
that doesn't crack. The other thing that this book did for me was that it really cracked the code of how power works in Lebanon and how power shifts and transfers between big national party and military politics right down to personal family politics and neighbourly disputes and petty crime.
And that's where we find you situated at the beginning of your essay, tracing the way in which power, in a sense, unravelled once the city was quieted by COVID.
Yes. Now, I had read several histories of Lebanon by this stage, and they are, well, I can highly recommend the historian David Hurst, actually. He was a former Guardian journalist. If you want to get the facts and you want to get the analysis of the politics, but I could not have written what I wrote in the essay without Sharif Majdalani.
And that's an extraordinary thing to know, I think, about something like a Caliber Prize-winning essay, is that it's a doorway. It's a doorway into a place that we hope that other people will then follow to the people who are writing from within it.
Ah, well, I couldn't have said it better. I hoped in writing the essay, I never expected it would win. I never expected it to be published. But I did hope somehow that it would get published somewhere along the line and that it would open Lebanon to other people who don't know it.
What are you working on now, Theo?
I'm in a strange in-between place because the shock of writing the essay has slightly thrown me off, and I'm just contemplating my next move. I do want to write more about Lebanon, and I am just figuring out how to do that. I think perhaps a set of companion pieces to this essay.
I think you have both a judging panel and a nation of readers who would say your personal essays are extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very good to know.
But you finished a poetry book while you were in Lebanon. Well, substantially while you were in Lebanon.
Yes, I did finish it just before we came home. And I am very glad to have done that. Once again, I had total freedom to write. And I'd been writing poems for many years in the cracks between other things, just eking them out wherever I could. And then I had these 2 years, as it turned out, and we thought it was going to be 3.5, in which I could write totally freely. And so I do have a completed poetry manuscript, yes.
And it is called?
It is called Beginning in Sight.
It's a beautiful title.
It's a phrase that comes from one of the poems that I wrote while I was in Lebanon. And I envisage it as a kind of, well, it was, it's a phrase to me that speaks of lockdowns, and the COVID pandemic, because the idea behind the phrase is that life has been broken off, suspended, stopped. And yet the beginning of the new time, the new era, whatever this strange new world is that we're entering into is just on the horizon. We can just see it if we could only get there. And it was, well, I thought I'd flip around the notion of the end being in sight.
I think that's a fishing way to end today might be if you would read a piece for us.
Oh, okay. Well,
do you have something?
I think I do. There are several poems in this book that are set in Lebanon in my mind, though a reader wouldn't necessarily pick that up. the thing that I was doing while writing these poems was thinking about Australia, thinking back home. It was like I was thinking and looking back at Australia through a telescope.
It's one of the great privileges, I think, of living an expat life is you can see the place that you that has made you.
Yes.
With a clarity you can't when you're inside of it.
Yes. Reading some of your short stories that you wrote while you were in Cairo, I had that same thought. You were very clearly thinking about the Western Australian landscape that you come from.
Yeah, haunted by it.
Yes. Well, we are haunted by our inner landscapes. I think that the other thing is that a lot of the poems in the book, particularly in its first half, don't have the most hopeful outlook. But I have tried to set the book out in a way that the hopeful poems do. You do come into the hopeful poems, and that you certainly end on a hopeful note.
And we're ending on a hopeful note today?
Yes, we are. I'm going to read the last poem in the book, which is called Hereafter, and it was written in the weeks after the explosion. Hereafter. Sunrise hesitated. Where glass panes faced east, they caught a gilt stare that outlived an instant, made birds break off their chat on new sprigs and look, slowed breeze that chafed bark, creaking as the cane chairs in which we sat, and where sunrise found us, up and watching for it. Errors uncorrected. The first so far on the meticulous scroll this day was inscribing over the rough ground of the last. With first light hanging, our cups steamed. We may have known then what it is to be ghosts, but that was nothing. The sheer dead stop, the red face of the sun, that was our delight. To have dazed the morning. Vexed it, forced it to hold its nerve.
That feels like an impossible thing to follow, so I won't even try. Thank you, Theo, for a wonderful conversation and for a soul-enriching friendship.
Oh, BJ, thank you so much, and thank you for the same things. Thank you, my opposite number in Cairo.
My opposite number in Beirut. And to ABR readers and listeners, please seek out Theo's essay in this month's issue of Australian Book Review.
Thanks for listening to the ABR podcast. We hope you'll join us again next week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not consider subscribing to ABR? Subscriptions start from just $10 per month for digital. Visit our website for more information. We'd like to thank Jack Khalil and Clancy Balin, who edit the podcast, as well as our contributors who take the time to read their articles and creative writing. And if you enjoy listening to the ABR podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes.